The word that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. In days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised above the hills. All the nations shall stream to it. Isaiah 2, 1 and 2.
Welcome to By the Well, a weekly podcast for preachers where we delve into the lectionary readings to help you preach the gospel. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. And today we'll be discussing the Isaiah reading in Advent 1, Year A, Isaiah 2, 1 to 5. Now, Robin, Advent. How would you talk about Advent to your community?
Ooh, it's a tough one really, because I think we tend to get so caught up just with a focus on Christmas. It's inevitable. The church tries to push back against that, but we are often in the season of actually realistically preparing for Christmas. And theologically, I would say Advent is looking to remind ourselves of the birth of Jesus and the incarnation, but it is also so much more. It is a looking beyond that and ultimately to the second coming of Jesus. So the very word Advent means coming or arrival. It has a history in the Roman Empire of when something like the arrival of an emperor, a victorious parade, in a modern equivalent might be if people can imagine the scene of a president or prime minister arriving, and there'd be a, you know, the car parade and the police and people lining the streets, or same for the arrival of the queen or something. That's an advent. It's a coming of someone important. And ultimately, in Christian tradition, Advent is looking for the coming of Jesus. Would you add anything to that?
Well, I think I might, and you may push back, and that is this phrase, the second coming, that I have problems with, because to me it implies that there's some space in which God isn't present, or the Spirit isn't present, or that all wasn't achieved in Jesus' death and resurrection. So I prefer to talk about the fulfillment of things.
Yep.
God's final fulfillment, when God is all in all, is the ultimate hope to which we're moving, or which comes towards us actually in Advent.
Yeah, and I think it's probably different language for the same thing, because I would say a full understanding of the second coming of Jesus is a reference to his return in glory, which is that eschatological time, the end time that Christians anticipate and the Bible anticipates, where God will gather up, you know, the whole of humanity, and there'll be recreation as we enter in really a new phase of relationship with God.
And what we get biblically, of course, too, is portrayals of this future, like visions of it, which are designed to help us to live in the now, which, and the now is often quite different from that future promise.
Yeah.
It's got suffering and incompleteness and so on, and we're starting to see those visions in this first week in
Advent, that's right,
in this Isaiah.
So we've chosen to really focus in these next few weeks on the Isaiah passage. We will look to some of the New Testament passages at times as well, but partly because in this prophet we get these grand visions of hope and renewal, this sort of poetic imagining of what the world would look like when it's at peace and reconciled with God. So I think, you know, the lectionary in its wisdom, and it's not perfect, there's lots of things the lectionary leaves out, but at this time of year, the lectionary readings remind us of that sort of larger themes of hope, I guess, that point us well beyond Christmas. It's not just about a baby Jesus.
And there are some ministers and worship leaders, of course, a few, who say no carols to be sung in Advent.
Yes.
For the very reason of keeping that vision or that aspect of Advent alive, that we're heading to this bigger thing and it's not Christmas yet.
No, that's right. One of my favourite carols that really makes the most sense to sing in this season is that famous O Come Emmanuel. And, I mean, I really think, quite frankly, you could sing it every single week of Advent, but your congregation or you might not agree.
You could start with just doing one verse.
You could.
And then build up.
Because it actually picks up, that if you look at the lyrics, it picks up a number of these images that we're going to be unpacking in Isaiah, and it really does accompany the lectionary particularly well during Year A.
Yeah.
So let's get into the text, Fran. What have you noticed about some of the images here in this Isaiah 2 passage?
Well, I'm struck immediately by a contrast of words in a way in the first sentence.
Mm-hmm.
The word that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw.
Mm.
Because we would expect to hear the word that, or to read, the word that Isaiah, son of Amoz, heard concerning Judah. So I'm immediately, I suppose, struck that this is a very visual thing that comes that we're about to read, and that the prophet was trying to have people see the truth,
yes.
See the truth, not just hear it, but see it around them. And there's ways in which, as worship leaders, we can capitalize on that visual visual emphasis through each week of Advent. You might choose to have a plow, for example, somewhere in your worship. You could build up a bit of a panorama
of
images. So you could have a plow this first week. You could have a stump
next week for the shoot of Jesse,
and you could somehow create a blue river for the third week and so on.
Yeah. So we're talking here then, I mean, that emphasis on the visual is these are almost imaginative dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Patricia Tull in her commentary talks about this first section of chapter 2 being a dream of what the world could be if people lived and, you know, lived towards God and lived with God. And, of course, it's paralleled. The lectionary has left it out. In the second part, there's what she describes as the nightmare. So we're getting offered two kind of pictures, if you like, these very visual pictures of the consequences of walking with God or not.
And part of that dream aspect, I think, comes through, doesn't it, in the use of mountain, the image of a mountain in here. We know mountains are biblically tremendously important.
Yep.
Moses was up the mountain when he received the Ten Commandments.
Mount Sinai.
And Jesus was often up mountains praying alone or teaching as he is in Matthew.
As in the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah,
mountains are really, in the biblical tradition, almost these spaces where humans and gods come close.
Mm. Mm. And what I think is interesting here is that when the mountain of the Lord, Zion, actually in reality was barely a hill.
Yes.
And so what we have here is hyperbole or exaggeration in the narrative to create a powerful image and a powerful hope.
That's right. And I think Isaiah's readers and the generations that followed would have known that Mount Zion was not the highest of the mountains, but metaphorically he's saying it is. It is the most important place because this is where we meet our God. This is where we meet Yahweh, the God of the Jewish people. And I think we're supposed to think here too of other biblical mountains, particularly Mount Sinai, because the image goes on to talk about that on this mountain of the Lord in verse 3, he may teach us his ways. We might walk in his paths, for out of Zion shall go forth instruction. And the word there in Hebrew is the Torah word. Mm. It's the word for the law or the instruction that's given on Mount Sinai. And I think, you know, whenever we're reading one part of the Bible, we're always doing this in and out work of, I think, narrow, you know, going down deep into the nitty gritty and then coming back out big picture. And Isaiah in particular invites us to do this, to think, you know, more broadly, how do these words and images work in the biblical tradition, because he's drawing on so much of what's come before him and, in this case, the Torah and the Pentateuch.
Mm. There's also a reversal of a theme of the river of life in this passage.
Mm.
In Ezekiel 47, where water flowed out of the temple, giving life to the people, here the people flow in. The nations, all peoples, including presumably the enemies of Israel, all are streaming in.
Yeah.
And it's the teaching that flows out from their coming in, the teaching of the Lord, the Torah, flows out. So this imagery of water.
Yes. Yeah, it's a play on language with the streaming in the river. Like it works in English, it works in Hebrew too. But I think here we might need to pause and go, go back a bit and think about context, because for me that verse becomes particularly meaningful when we think about what's going on in Isaiah's context. You mentioned enemies, Fran. What's the setting here in chapter 2 of Isaiah?
Isaiah was an 8th century prophet. So I think we know Isaiah, well, most people know, is a very long book in the Bible, mm-hmm. and it spans a couple of hundred years of history. And scholars are in large agreement that it was probably written by three different authors. The part we're looking at now, I think, is generally understood to have been written by the 8th century prophet called Isaiah.
Yeah.
There was a lot of war and violence and destruction and suffering going on in this prophet's lifetime. And the passage that we look at today is actually comes a bit later in the 6th century, around the exile, second exile, and the destruction of Jerusalem. So the Israelites had suffered tremendous threat to their identity and their faith and their physical well-being.
Yeah, and if we take that scholarly suggestion seriously that chapter 2 here comes from that 6th century period, it means that it potentially reflects Isaiah or whoever's prophetic teaching after Jerusalem has been destroyed, and therefore after the very place of worship, the temple that was so utterly central to Jewish life and faith, has been destroyed. And so in the midst of such really unimaginable destruction, I mean, for much of the Bible, the way the prophets talk or they reflect the people's assumption that God's house could never be destroyed. There's no way that could actually happen. So the unimaginable has happened.
And chapter 1 actually of Isaiah does unpack some of that.
Yeah, it does.
It's a very different passage from the one before us today. In fact, people have talked about there being almost two beginnings in Isaiah's book, chapter 1 or chapter 2.
Yeah, and if you do sit down and read through these first sort of particularly 12 chapters, I guess, as preparation for Advent, you see these echoes here of real terror and real fear. But for me that's important because it makes the word of hope and renewal here so utterly amazing for the faith it reflects, really, the faith that God will still do something new, that the promises of God will still hold, even when all the evidence in that time and place suggests otherwise.
This appears to be utterly impossible, although, as we know from other sources, nothing is impossible for God.
Yep.
But that, you know, does seem, and that in a way when I think about its use in worship, and, you know, I was talking about visual images before, it's one tack you could take would be to really consider what are the amazing, life-giving, compassionate things and people in your community doing, highlight them, create a dramatic story around it. Don't make it up, but talk about it as a miracle in amongst the outrage online and the argy-bargy politically, nationally and internationally. There are remarkable stories of love and commitment and salvation going on around us all the time. And in a way, reminding our communities that they're in the midst of that, and they are, many of them, engaging in it and building that. I mean, you don't need to go perhaps to the extent of Isaiah's poetry, and maybe it's beyond some of us
anyway.
I think
we should aspire to that.
But, I think Isaiah encourages perhaps an attempt or a playful attempt, but playful attempt to highlight those images, those visions in our own world.
Yeah, I think as Christians we are often so aware of, you know, the violence and destruction in our world, and we lament that and we pray for that, and all of that is entirely appropriate, of course, that we perhaps forget to also talk about where there is hope and renewal. So before we were talking about Advent and these sort of two landscapes, if you like, the more immediate one, which is looking for Christmas, and the broader one, which is looking for the fullness of God at the end of time. And I think perhaps in between those two things is what you're suggesting, Fran, which is that Advent and these Bible readings invite us to also pause and be really attentive to what God is doing now, that God is already in our midst, is already and continues and always has continued to do to fulfill God's promises.
Well, I think I remember the phrase the now and the not yet from some
theology class back in the day.
But that God is doing God's thing now, but also it is not complete. So we live in this in-between time, and what we're called to do really is with biblical visions like this, is to allow this vision of the future to shape our present.
Yes.
So that we live as if this were true, not in an imaginary way, but live it because it is true, but live it now, even though the narrative around us tells us otherwise.
Yeah, so, I mean, that invites us, I think, to think with our communities, what would it mean if we lived as if all the nations were streaming to God's holy place? In other words, if we unpack this imagery, what would it mean to live where our enemies, the people we consider our enemies, or people who have actually in the past harmed us or done us harm, were actually walking with us towards God's holy place? And what does it mean to be a community that then hears the Torah, the instruction, the law of God, together with those people? And, of course, the famous images of that perhaps is the best known part of Isaiah 2, of the swords being beaten into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks, that weapons become tools. It's an image of both reconciliation and peace and rebuilding together in a way.
And an indication that in this new world, these things are not required anymore. There's no need for swords or spears. They don't even need to learn about war. It's not that war might happen. Actually, it's redundant to even learn how to engage in it because it's not a thing.
Yeah.
I'm sure hearers will know these words from elsewhere in the Bible. It's Micah 4, verses 1 to 5, we also hear.
Yeah, very similar phrases, yeah.
And scholars aren't sure which one came first. And just as a bit of an aside, you find in Joel 3, chapter 10, I think, a reversal of this, so that it's turned back into a war sort of passage in Joel.
Yeah, and I mean, this is one of the things the Bible does, right, is it reflects the full range of human potential and fragility, or frailty might be a better word, which is both our ability when we work with God to be peacemakers, to be justice bringers, to be merciful, the kind of visions of Israel and that kind of community that Isaiah and other prophets offered. But then it also reflects that very real tendency of humans to sometimes want to lapse back to violence
and revenge.
Or revenge, who seek revenge because we are human and that is part of what we kind of do, really. There is a kind of a call at the end here to come let us walk in the light of the Lord, which could be used liturgically. But there's also a sense of a call to repentance, I think, but both in this passage and in Advent in general, a time to reflect on how, if we let this vision inform our present, how we are living into it or not, perhaps.
The gap between, well, that's part of the now and not yet, I guess. It's facing up to the reality that we do fall short as communities. Like, we have a very individualistic way of thinking as Western educated people. And certainly there is obviously invitation and command to reflect personally. But these are really texts for communities.
Yeah.
And part of that is to, are we living justly? Are we looking after the poor? Are we loving our enemies? Although that's taking something from the New Testament immediately.
No, but it's, those threads are here.
So that an Advent is an invitation to be honest.
Yes.
And to turn actively back to God in those times and when you know that you're actually not.
Yeah. I mean, it might be worth us just reminding hearers that Isaiah here, part of these prophetic visions is, I think Isaiah would have been, he was a preacher, so these are preached texts. Mm-hmm. So we are, as preachers, are standing in a long tradition of other preachers, and there's a sense that we need to take their words and sometimes change them, sometimes explain them, sometimes illuminate them to preach in our context.
I find that quite a liberating idea, actually. Sorry to break in there.
No.
Well, just the idea that, yes, these were preached texts by other prophets and we take them and we prayerfully interpret them and you know, if we're set aside to do this as ordained people, that we remain committed to the tradition but break it open into a, our context and what it's saying to us.
Yep. And we get a model of that in the New Testament. I mean, the obvious place is somewhere like Luke 4 where, you know, Jesus picks up and reads from the scroll of Isaiah and then basically says, this is me. This is talking about me, and he's reinterpreting that prophecy or interpreting that prophecy for his time and context. And we're now 2,000 years on and we stand in that tradition of these biblical passages and doing that work of well, how do they speak into our context? Mm. I think the last thing I want to say here that I think is also important is this teaching and walking in paths.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is such an ancient idea and it gets to the heart of Jewish faith that you can't know God and live as one of God's faithful people if it's not really infused throughout your whole life. This isn't just about the temple sacrifices you do once a week or on special occasions. This is about walking, so your ethical behavior. And this emphasis here on teaching that even in Isaiah's vision of some future redemptive, almost perfected place, really, there's still a need for learning and teaching. I'm a bit biased as an educator that I think this is so important.
Well, I would share that bias as well. And I guess there is something here for us as a church to consider whether, in fact, we do take seriously as often as we could that commitment and that necessity for learning and that part of faithful living is studying the text and wrestling with it with yourself and with other people and seeking to grow more deeply into it. And that's how we keep one another accountable. That's how the tradition grows. And I think, I think this is a good reminder for those who might forget or think it's a side issue or...
Yeah, that's right.
So on.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's at the heart of faith. So just wrapping up here, do you any last words, sermon titles? What would you preach if you were preaching on this? And since I've just put you on the spot, I'll say what I'd preach. I love this idea of streaming up the mountain. It is a complete reversal that you're streaming with your enemy. Like, I think that verse alone is just so rich in its imagery for what it suggests, what would it mean to stream up towards God with all the nations. It's a universal salvation image here that we gather up everyone with us. That would probably be something I would play with in a sermon and think about.
I'd probably do something similar, but I'd also want to really emphasise the power of these sorts of visions to transform the people.
Mm.
And in a way, when we come to church, or when we come to a church study group, or we come to hear a sermon and worship together and receive communion, we are opening ourselves up to be transformed by the sermon and by that communion. So I think I might, it could draw some parallels between what it is we're doing every Sunday and these sorts of images. And that harks back to what I was saying earlier about the preacher's capacity or invitation here to really highlight some of the visions, for want of a better
visual,
word, in their own communities of hope and new life and peace. As a way of showing the people, hopefully, how they're engaged in God's good work in the world.
Yep. I really like that. And one of the things that's a bit of a pet peeve of mine in the Christian tradition is we often use the word gospel or good news and we think just of the New Testament, but, of course, we've got good news right here in the heart of the Jewish prophetic tradition.
And it's universal. It's for that's all right. the nations. It's not just for Israel.
Yep.
Which initially before the exilic times
was often was slightly narrower.
But this is for, it's universally for the nations.
Yep. So that brings us to the end of our first episode. We hope that this has given you some ideas about what you might preach and teased out some themes to help your thinking as you prepare to lead worship wherever that might be. You can subscribe to this podcast by The Well wherever you listen to podcasts. Please rate it, share it. You can also find more information or listen to it through our website, bythewell.com.au. I've been Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. This podcast has been made with the support of Pilgrim Theological College in Melbourne, the Uniting Church in Australia, and the technical wizardry of Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.